Chapter 44. As Penner had suggested, being shot down in flames was not a likely prospect. The ultralight-powered gliders that Pitt and Giordino were to fly off the landing pad of the U.S. Navy detection and tracking ship Ralph R. Bennett looked like pint-sized stealth bombers. They were painted a dark gray and sported the same weird Buck Rogers shape that made them impossible to see on radar. They sat like alien bugs under the shadow of the ship's giant box-shaped phased array radar. The six-story-high system was composed of 18,000 antenna elements that collected a wide range of intelligence data on Soviet missile tests with an incredible degree of accuracy. The Ralph R. Bennett had been pulled away from its mission near the Kamchatka Peninsula by presidential order to launch the power gliders and monitor activity in and around Soseki Island. Lieutenant Commander Raymond Simpson, a man on the young side of 30 with sun-bleached blonde hair, stood next to the men from Numa on the open deck. There was an air of capable toughness about him as he kept a tight eye on his maintenance crew, who swarmed around the tiny aircraft, fueling tanks and examining instruments and controls. "Think we can manage without a check flight?" Pitt asked. "A piece of cake for old Air Force pilots like yourselves," answered Simpson lightly. "Once you get the hang of flying while lying on your stomach, you'll wish you could take one home and keep it for your personal use." Pitt had never laid eyes on one of the odd, ultralight craft until he and Giordino landed on the ship by an Osprey tilt-motor aircraft an hour before. Now, after only 40 minutes of class instruction, they were supposed to fly them over 100 kilometers of open sea and make an injury-free landing on the dangerously rugged surface of Soseki Island. "How long have these birds been around?" Giordino queried. "The Ibis X-20," Simpson corrected him, "is fresh off the drawing boards." "Oh, God," groaned Giordino, "they're still experimental." "Quite so. They haven't completed their testing program. Sorry I couldn't have given you something more proven, but your people in Washington were in an awful rush, insisting we deliver them halfway across the world in 18 hours and all." Pitt said consideringly, "They do fly, naturally." "Oh, naturally," Simpson said enthusiastically. "I've got 10 hours flying time in them myself. Super aircraft, designed for one-man reconnaissance flights. Powered by the very latest in compact turbine engines that provide a 300-kilometer-per-hour cruising speed with a range of 120 kilometers. The Ibis is the most advanced power glider in the world." "Maybe when you get discharged you can open up a dealership," Giordino said dryly. "Don't I wish," said Simpson, without feeling the barb. The skipper of the radar ship, Commander Wendell Harper, stepped onto the landing pad with a large photo gripped in one hand. Tall and beefy with a solid paunch, Harper's bow-legged gait gave him the appearance of a man who had just ridden across the Kansas Plains for the Pony Express. "Our meteorology officer promises you'll have a 4-knot tailwind for the flight," he said pleasantly, "so fuel won't be a problem." Pitt nodded a greeting. "I hope our reconnaissance satellite came up with a decent landing site." Harper spread an enlarged computer-enhanced satellite photo up against a bulkhead. "Not exactly O'Hare Airport in Chicago. The only flat spot on the island is a grassy area measuring 20 by 60 meters. Plenty of room for an upwind landing," Simpson injected optimistically. Pitt and Giordino moved in and stared at the amazingly detailed picture. The central feature was a landscaped garden clustered around a rectangular lawn that was only open from the east. The other three sides were thickly bordered by trees, shrubbery, and pagoda-roofed buildings with high curved bridges leading down from open balconies to an oriental pond at one end. Like condemned men who'd just been told they had a choice of being hanged on the gallows or shot against a wall, Pitt and Giordino looked into each other's eyes and exchanged tired, cynical smiles. "Hide out until rescued," Giordino muttered unhappily. "Why do I get the feeling my ballot box has been stuffed?" "Nothing like arriving at the front door with a brass band," Pitt agreed. "Something wrong?" asked Harper innocently. "Victims of high-pressure salesmanship," Pitt replied. "Someone in Washington took advantage of our gullible nature." Harper looked uneasy. "Do you wish to scrub the operation?" "No," Pitt sighed. "In for a dime, in for a dollar." "I don't mean to crowd you, but sunset is only an hour away. You'll need daylight to see your way in." At that moment, Simpson's crew chief came over and informed him the power gliders were serviced and ready for launch. Pitt looked at the fragile little aircraft. Calling it a glider was a misnomer. Without the strong thrust of its turbine engine, it would drop like a brick. Unlike the high, wide wing of a true ultralight, with its maze of wires and cables, the airfoils on the Ibis were short and stubby and internally braced. It also lacked the ultralight's canard wing that resisted stalls and spins. He was reminded of the adage about the bumblebee as having all the wrong features for flight, and yet it flew as well as, if not better than, many other insects that Mother Nature had aerodynamically designed. After finishing their pre-flight check, the flight crew stood off to the side of the landing pad. In Pitt's mind, they all wore the look of spectators at an auto race anticipating a crash. "Maybe we can land in time for cocktails," he said, pulling on his helmet. With routine calm, Giordino merely yawned. "If you get there first, order me a vodka martini straight up." Harper incredulously realized that glacial nonchalance was the highest state of emotional nervousness these men were capable of displaying. "Good luck," he said, offering both men a firm handshake. "We'll monitor you all the way. Be sure to activate your signal unit after landing. We'd like to tell Washington you came down safely." Pitt gave him a wry smile. "If I'm able." "Never a doubt," Simpson said, as if cheering the home team. "Mind you don't forget to set the self-destruct timer. Can't make the Japs a gift of our ultralight technology. Goodbye, and thanks to you and your crews for looking out for us." Giordino touched Pitt on the shoulder, gave him an encouraging wink of one eye, and without another word walked toward his craft. Pitt approached his power glider and eased in from the bottom through a narrow hatch in the fabric-covered fuselage and onto his stomach until his body fit the contours of a body-length foam rubber pad. His head and shoulders were elevated only slightly higher than his legs, elbows swinging free a centimeter above the floor. He adjusted his safety harness and belts that strapped across his shoulder blades and buttocks. Then he inserted his outstretched feet into grips on the vertical stabilizer and brake pedals, and then gripped the stubby control stick in one hand while adjusting the throttle setting with the other. He waved through the minuscule windscreen at the crew, who were standing by to release tie-down cables, and he engaged the starter. The turbine, smaller than a beer keg, slowly increased its whine until it became a high-pitched shriek. He looked over at Giordino, just making out a set of spirited brown eyes. Pitt made a thumbs-up gesture that was returned accompanied with a grin. One last sweep of the instruments to make sure the engine was functioning as stated in the flight manual, which he barely had time to scan, and a final glimpse at the ensign flapping on the stern under a stiff breeze that beat in from the port side. Unlike from an aircraft carrier, a forward takeoff was blocked by the great radar housing and the superstructure. So Commander Harper had brought the Bennett around into a quartering wind. Pitt held the brake on by pressing his toes outward. Then he ran up the throttle, feeling the Ibis try to surge forward. The lip of the landing pad looked uncomfortably close. The lifting force of the Ibis occurred at 45 kph. The combined wind force and the speed of the Bennett gave him a 25 kph running start, but that still left 20 kph to achieve before the landing wheels rolled into air. The moment of decision. He signaled the flight crew to release the tie-down cables. Then Pitt eased the throttle to the full stop, and the Ibis shuddered under the force of the breeze and the thrust of the turbine. His eyes fixed on the end of the landing pad, Pitt released the brakes and the Ibis leaped ahead. 5 meters, 10, and then gently but firmly he pulled the control stick back. The craft's little nose wheel lifted, and Pitt could see clouds. With only 3 meters to spare, he drilled the Ibis into the sky and over the restless sea. He banked and leveled off at 40 meters and watched Giordino sweep into the air behind him. One circle around the ship, dipping his wings at the waving crew of the Ralph R. Bennett, and he set a course for Soseki Island toward the west. The waters of the Pacific rushed beneath the Ibis undercarriage, dyed a sparkling iridescent gold by the setting sun. Pitt slipped the throttle back to a cruise setting. He wished he could put the little craft through its paces, gain altitude, and try some acrobatics. But it was not to be. Any wild maneuvers might show on a Japanese radar screen. In straight and level flight at a wave-top altitude, the Ibis was invisible. Pitt now began to wonder about a reception committee. He saw little hope of escaping from the retreat's compound. A nice setup, he thought grimly. Crash land in Suma's front yard from out of nowhere and create bedlam among the security forces as a distraction for the others. The crew in the Bennett Situation Room had detected the incoming radar signals sent out by Suma's security defenses, but Commander Harper decided not to jam the probes. He allowed the Bennett to be monitored, rightly assuming the island's defense command would relax once they saw the lone U.S. ship was sailing leisurely away toward the east as if on a routine voyage. Pitt concentrated on his navigation, keeping an eye on the compass. At their present airspeed, he calculated, they should set down on the island in 35 minutes. A few degrees north or south, however, and they might miss it completely. It was all seat-of-the-pants flying and navigation. The Ibis could not afford the extra weight of an onboard computer and an automatic pilot. He rechecked speed, wind direction, and velocity, and his estimated course heading 4 times to make certain no errors slipped in. The thought of running out of fuel and ditching in a rough sea in the dead of night was a hardship he could do without. Pitt noted grimly that the radios had been removed. By Jordan's orders, no doubt, so neither he nor Giordino would be tempted to launch into idle conversation and give their presence away. After 27 minutes had passed, and only a small arc of the sun showed on the horizon line, Pitt peered forward through the windscreen. There it was, a purple-shadowed blemish between sea and sky, more imagined than real. Almost imperceptibly it became a hard, tangible island, its jagged cliffs rising vertically from the rolling swells that crashed into their base. Pitt turned and glanced out his side window. Giordino hung just off his tail and less than 10 meters behind and to his right. Pitt waggled his wings and pointed. Giordino pulled closer until Pitt could see him nod in reply and gesture with the edge of his hand toward the island. One final check of his instruments, and then he tilted the Ibis into a gentle bank until he came at the center of the island from out of the darkening eastern sky. There would be no circling to study the layout of the ground, no second approach if he came in too low or high. Surprise was their only friend. They had one chance to set their little Ibises on the garden lawn before surface-to-air missiles burst in their laps. He could clearly see the pagoda roofs and the opening in the trees around the open garden. He spotted a helicopter pad that wasn't on Penner's mock-up, but he dismissed it as a secondary landing site because it was too small and ringed with trees. An easy twist of the wrist to the left, right, and then hold. He lowered the throttle setting a notch at a time. The sea was a blur, the towering cliff face rushing closer, swiftly filling the windscreen. He pulled the stick back slightly. And then suddenly, as if a rug was pulled out from under him, the sea was gone and his wheels were hurtling only a few meters above the hard lava rock of the island. Straight in, without a sideways glance, a gentle kick to the right rudder pedal to compensate for a crosswind. He soared over a row of bushes, the tires of his landing gear grooving the tops. Throttle back on idle, the Ibis settled beyond the point of recovery. A tender tug on the stick and the power glider flared. He felt the landing wheels thump as they lightly touched down on the lawn no more than 5 meters from the edge of a flower bed. Pitt flipped the kill switch and applied gentle but firm pressure on the brakes. Nothing happened. There was no slowing force pulling his body forward. The grass was wet and the tires slid across the lawn as though coated with oil. The urge to cram the throttle full forward and pull back on the stick was overpowering, especially since his face was only a few centimeters from the nose of the Ibis. Impact with a tree, a building, a rock wall. Directly ahead, a row of shrubs ablaze in autumn red and gold shielded any solid barrier beyond. Pitt tensed, bent his head down, and hung on. The craft was still traveling at 30 kph when it tore through the shrubs, ripping the wings off and plowing with a great shuddering splash into a small pond filled with huge carp. For a moment, there was a deathly silence, broken a few seconds later by splintering and tearing noise as Giordino's Ibis ripped through the bushes alongside Pitt's shattered craft and skidded to a stop in a sand garden, devastating intricate designs precisely raked in an artful composition. Pitt struggled to release his safety harness but was pinned by the legs, and his arms had no freedom of movement. His head was half submerged in the pond, and he had to tilt his face up to breathe. He could plainly see a school of giant white, black, and gold carp, their gaping mouths opening and closing, large round eyes staring blankly at the intruder in their private domain. Giordino's fuselage was relatively undamaged, and he managed to extricate himself without a problem. He rushed over, leaped into the pond, and surged through the muck and lily pads like a maddened hippo. With strength built from long years of bodybuilding, he tore apart the crumpled structural braces that pinned Pitt's legs as if they were toothpicks. Then he unfastened the safety harness, pulled Pitt out of the mangled craft, and dragged him to the bank. "You okay?" he asked. "Bruised chins and a bent thumb," Pitt replied. "Thanks for the deliverance." "I'll send you a bill," said Giordino, distastefully eyeing his muck-covered boots. Pitt removed his crash helmet and threw it in the pond, causing the gawking carp to burst for the safety of the lily pads. He nodded at the wrecked power gliders. They'll be coming for us. You'd best switch on the signal units and set the destruct timers. While Giordino went about the business of alerting the Bennett of their arrival before setting the timers on small packets of plastic explosives carried inside the aircraft, Pitt rose stiffly to his feet and stared around the garden. It appeared deserted. The army of human and robotic guards did not materialize. The porches and windows of the buildings were empty of life. He found it impossible to believe no one had heard the cry of the turbine engines and the sounds of the twin impacts from within the thin walls of the Japanese-style constructions. Someone had to live in the neighborhood. The gardeners must be about somewhere. The grounds were immaculate and displayed constant care. Giordino returned. "We've less than 2 minutes to make tracks before they blow," he said quickly. "I'm out of here," Pitt spoke as he began jogging toward the forested area behind the resort compound. And then he stiffened suddenly as a strange electronic voice called out, "Remain where you stand." Pitt and Giordino both reacted by darting behind the cover of heavy brush and the safety of the trees, crouching and swiftly moving from one to another, trying to distance themselves from the unknown pursuer. They'd only covered 50 meters when they abruptly met a high fence that was bristling with electrified wire and insulators. "The shortest escape in history," Pitt muttered dolefully. At that instant, the explosives in the ibises went off within 5 seconds of each other. Pitt couldn't see, but he imagined the ugly, indolent carp flying through the air. He and Giordino turned to face the music, and although they'd been warned, they were not totally prepared for the three mechanical apparitions that emerged from the underbrush in a half-circle, cutting off all avenues of escape. The trio of robots did not look like the semi-human figures out of television and motion pictures. These traveled on rubber tractor treads and showed no human qualities except maybe speech. The mobile automated vehicles were loaded with a jumbled assortment of articulated arms, video and thermal image cameras, speakers, computers, and a quad of automatic rifles pointed directly at Pitt and Giordino's navels. "Please do not move or we will kill you." "They don't mince words, do they?" Giordino was frankly disbelieving. Pitt studied the center robot and observed that it appeared to be operated under a sophisticated telepresence system by a controller at a distant location. "We are programmed to recognize different languages and respond accordingly," said the middle robot in a hollow voice, sounding surprisingly articulate. "You cannot escape without dying. Our guns are guided by your body heat." There was a brief, uneasy silence as Pitt and Giordino briefly looked at each other with the looks of men committed to a job that was accomplished and they could do no more. Carefully, slowly, they raised their hands above their heads, aware that the gun muzzles pointing at them in the horizontal position never wavered. "I do believe we've been cut off at the pass by a mechanical posse," Pitt muttered softly. "At least they don't chew tobacco," Giordino grunted. 12 guns in the front, an electrified fence at their backs, there was no way out. Pitt could only hope the robot's controllers were wise enough to know he and Giordino presented no threat. "Is this a good time to ask them to take us to their leader?" Giordino spoke through a grin that was cold as stone. "I wouldn't if I were you," Pitt answered mildly. "They're liable to shoot us for using a bad cliché."